This is continuing the interview with Douglas Burston on October 19th, 2001.
So anyway, they had a joint program to discuss research problems. Okay, one of the groups, it was either four or five, and as I recall, one of the groups was extractive metallurgy mineral processing, and that included Milt Wadsworth, Roshan Bapu, and myself. On that part, there was somebody else on pharmaceuticals, so there had been maybe three people on pharmaceuticals, there were three people on corrosion, three people related to cloth and fibers, and then three people on disease. When they dammed up the Nile, the little tributaries have this parasite that people might wash their clothes, might bathe in it, and then this parasite, histiopsis? I hadn't planned this, so I'll find out what that's called. Very serious, terrible parasite that gets into them because it's in this stagnant little streams that the days when the Nile flooded washed it all out. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we were there, and so there was about a week of meetings, obviously each group with their counterparts at the National Research Center of or National Search Council of in Cairo. And so it was, like I said, Wadsworth, Roshan Bapu, and myself, and we discussed what some of the problems were in Egyptian metallurgy. One of them, their iron ore, for example, had been a porous material, and in it was the pores were filled with salt, sodium chloride, and you put salt in water to dissolve it, but you try try to wash out dissolved salt as a process, and it just doesn't go. So when they would have a lot of corrosion and so on in their iron making steel plants because of all the chlorine that was there and had to get. Would probably evaporate when the sodium chloride was, when the common salt was in the blast furnace. So that was, I remember, one of the problems. That wouldn't have been one that I dealt with, but another one related to phosphate, fertilizer. How to upgrade their minerals, etc. And then I'll come back to that in a few minutes. So anyway, after the meeting, I think there were field excursions to different places for these different groups. And we went to Bapu and Wadsworth and I went to Hagamadi, which is where the big aluminum plant is, and this was one of the world's greatest aluminum plants. And what it was built for was because of the power out of Aswan Dam. And it was built by the Russians, and so you could see all this Russian equipment and Russian control boxes and controllers and all looking, big and rather massive and crude, at the time. And the in-tourist guide, when I made that trip out to Samarkand, she had said she'd been 5 years in Egypt, which is obviously she was down here when the Russians were building this plant. What was interesting was the bauxite, not the bauxite, but the alumina, came from Australia. And they don't mine any of that in this power that was there. And what they do, they said something like half of the aluminum goes back to Australia to pay for the alumina, and a quarter of it went to Russia to pay for the plant, and then a quarter of it they had to sell. Something like that was the economics of it. This was a huge, huge, huge plant, and it's only about 1 hour by car to Luxor. So we went to Luxor, visited the Luxor Temple, and then we went to the Valley of the Kings, and this was 78 or 79. So we it was very interesting to visit. We went into King Tut's tomb, there were a lot of other tombs, and some of the bigger ones, very massive ones. You've seen pictures like the National Geographic, who are of a mayor or something, a lot lesser person. So all the paintings were on the wall. I read today that they don't let people in these very much anymore because of the humidity of having tourists inside. So we really had this
very lucky,
lovely tour, and we were sitting out late in the afternoon after we got back from the Valley of Kings, which is across the river, eating lunch, when somebody started to talk about Karnak Temple. And I'd never even, and here, finally, and it wasn't on our agenda, and so few of us said, well, we must go see this. Well, Karnak's the one with the huge, massive columns. You always see the picture. We rented a taxi and went there approaching sunset, and that's a place to see, not Luxor Temple.
Now, one of them was moved, wasn't it?
No, those were all at the Aswan Dam area. Yeah. Those were moved because of the high dam. That's the ones we've seen the picture. I never got down there. But at the front of Luxor Temple is on one side is a big obelisk, and on the other side the obelisk is gone, and that's the one that's in Paris that Napoleon took. And so on. But there's a little museum, let's say a museum in Luxor, that's got hardly anything in it related to King Tut. And you go back to Cairo, and that museum, have you been in Cairo?
I have not.
That museum in Cairo in 78 or 9 was just like a warehouse. It had everything you can imagine, but just kind of, this looked like a warehouse, including this great big room full of King Tut stuff. I don't know why they don't put, because there's four of about everything in the King Tut part of the Cairo Museum. But they ought to put some of it down there in Luxor. I don't understand them not to do that. But anyway, when I was there, there'd be in a little card saying, this item is in transport to the U.S. and that item and so on. And remember there was a King Tut display, and we went to it in L.A. and we also went to it here. And it was beautifully done, and they used the money to then upgrade the Cairo Museum. So we also went to a lot of different pyramids. There's some pyramids that are a place called Saqqara. They're the oldest ones. They're kind of big step pyramids. And our guide was this guy with a candle underneath, and so on. As I say, this is 78, so it's before they really build up the
tourism.
Oh, and of course, what really amazes one is how the valley is only a mile, 2 miles wide, where it's green, and sometimes it widens out a little bit. And it's just sand. And I had not realized the kind of pictures, you know, we see of the three great pyramids. You think they're way out in the desert, but they're right on the edge of where the green stops, of the Nile Valley. And I remember flying in there, I looked out the airplane and I saw all this brown, light brown area, and it looked just like a shoelace or a string, black string. And I was wondering what that was. Well, of course, that says we were coming in high. It was the Nile Valley.
Yeah, yeah.
And all those people live on that, just that little strip of land. And of course, it fans out into the delta. But I think there were 1978, 38 million people, and something like 78 million are there now.
It's
huge. They've got a terrible population control problem. Obviously, a poor land, I would think, and you know, Cairo is just a parking lot as far as travel and so. Anyway, out of that came an AID project that I had, and so I then made maybe three other trips to Egypt. And AID, you know, is U.S. money that comes from payback of loans, but they don't pay it back. It's spent there. And so I was involved with these professors, one of which is my own former student, Abdel Abazid, a professor at the University of Cairo. One, Dasuki El Galani, ELGALLANI, I think. I'll check that out. He did his PhD with my brother Maury at Colorado School of Mines. A very bright, able soul. And this was working on processing a low-grade phosphate ore that they have. And so I, as I said, was there.
What do they mine in?
Pardon me?
What do they mine in Egypt?
Well, iron ore and, you know, what else they mine? Hey, I'll answer that so I don't sound ignorant, but they got a mining department there.
That
so
surprises me.
There may be
stone quarrying, of course.
But right, I would find. I'll find out what.
Well, there were ancient mines.
They had ancient gold mines. Right. Though, you know, they had underground gold mines, which must have been terrible, mined by slaves. You know, 2000 BC. In the Sinai area, there's some mining. Hey, I'll find out. We'll make it all sound like we aren't ignorant when this gets written up. But anyway, they have their phosphate, the fish bones and stuff have pyrite inside the hollow fish bones, which means this pyrite's about 5 microns in diameter, which means you can't grind it and separate it out. And when they try to make fertilizer or phosphoric acid out of it, it's black. And the farmers want to buy beige-colored fertilizer, and come, which is what the Moroccan and the Florida stuff is like. So, you know, our efforts were, you know, could we remove the pyrite, which, because of this fine size, is really this iron sulfide precipitated inside the pores of the fish bones, yeah, uh-huh. and the fossil. But there is I think it's called Abu Tatur, and I will A-B-U and then T-A-T-U-R, I think, or maybe it's Tatur. This is a huge mesa, and there's a billion tons or more of phosphate on this, which is why the Egyptians were working on it. And this mesa apparently is about 500 feet high, and it's flat on top, and maybe about 100 feet down or 50 feet down is about 50 feet of the phosphate. And there's a billion tons of that phosphate. Mm-hmm. So they had tried to mine this, but you know, given that how high it was, when they were doing an experimental mine of it, I wasn't connected with it, but this was in during that time, it caved and killed about 30 people or something. Mm-hmm. As you can see, what a tough problem that mm-hmm. would be to, mm-hmm. how would you go about doing that? I heard that, you know, Abzi told me they actually built a railroad all the way to the place, and then and now they've just given up because they're mm-hmm. not able to sell this product. But the Egyptians built a railroad from the sea coast to this mesa. And this is now a several hundred mile long railroad. So their planning wasn't, I mean, this railroad is recent, I mean, uh-huh. 10-15 years old. I will get some information because it's a lesson, I think, mm-hmm. to be learned there. But they had, you know, international support for.
Now, were you working with producers or with students? Or?
Well, I was just with. I assume these professors had, you know, some grad students or something doing some of the work. And we were actually trying to determine how to make some of the separations. They do have some phosphate where there's a high dolomite, which is a calcium magnesium carbonate mixed with the apatite. And so we were involved on studying the flotation behavior of dolomite and apatite as part of this program. And that was really quite fundamental, and it's also something I've been doing here, so that worked out. But that was really an interesting program. So I was there two times, and then I'll come back to the first time. I can tell you now it's 78 because Abazid, who is my student, I always to this day get a birthday card from him, and he had me and maybe Wadsworth went also to dinner. He had a birthday party for me. It was my 50th birthday party. And so other people went out and ate various places, and including the wife of a vice president of pharmaceutical company, ate crushed sugar cane, and that can put you in bed for a couple of days with dysentery. I wouldn't drink sugar cane juice anyway, but people just, you know, that's one of the things some of these countries they do. So I miss going and getting where a few people got sick because of Abazid having this wonderful birthday party for me at his house. That again was the first trip. But so anyway, this kind of program was interesting to, you know, have this, these discussions with him.
Did you think you thought the AID program was worthwhile?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think so. And then another time, one of them, Peg, went along with me, and we again made the same aluminum trip in Luxor. This was enough years later that you could see the change in the Cairo Museum, etc. But I was impressed with the general manager of this aluminum plant. I mean, he had ideas of he was trying to grow trees and plants. Apparently there's a tremendous flow of fresh water under the sand, because the plant would be up on the sand, but you could pump out fresh water there. And he was doing that to try to create agricultural land where the aluminum plant was. And I could tell this manager was just first rank, and then I learned about a year later he had a farm on the edge of the west of Alexandria. He went up to take a look at his farm, and there were a lot of squatters on there, and he wanted to get the squatters off of his land, and they shot him, and about 30 days later in the hospital, he died from that. Like I said, I could just see that this guy really was on the ball. But not an old man, he was 50s in age, but you could tell he was a good leader of, probably a little aggressive, which was that demise kind of thing. Anyway, these international cooperations are quite useful,
Now the one in Italy was not AID, was it?
No. Italy was one of these NSF cooperatives, and they go on right now, a lot of them. But what happened was, it was proposed that we have a U.S. Italy cooperative workshop, of which I was an American chair, and Giorgio Ranelli, who I mentioned earlier, was the Italian chair. And they were, I think, we had 10 or 12, no more than that, from this country. And then maybe, the equal number from Italy. And we visited, we split our group into a couple of subgroups to go visit a few institutes and so on in Italy. I was in Rome, Maury was in, my brother was there, and some went to Sardinia to see the Cagliari group. Then our meeting was in a hotel, the Italians set that up, Lago Maggiore, and I remember looking out of our room, was right across, was a little island, and I mean there was only 40 feet of water maybe, between the island and the shore, but right there was Toscanini's house. Mm. We've all probably seen pictures of his Italian summer place. And so we met for a week to work out, cooperative programs, and then proposals were eventually, again, all related to mineral processing. And so I had a cooperative program on flotation with the CNR group, of which Rinelli was the director, and two of my grad students on different occasions spent 4 to 6 months in Italy at that institute conducting research. And one, and this would be related to flotation chemicals, and one, Jim Hansen, actually used the research he did there for his MS thesis here.
Wow.
And another one, Jim Gebhardt, who afterwards worked for the Bureau of Mines, now as part of a small company in Salt Lake. He was in Rome there for 4 or 5 months on that. And then with the funding that comes, we pay for the Americans, whether we go and so on. And then an Italian researcher from that institute, Dr. Maria Barbaro, she came here for a few months. And her pay is then paid by the Italian component. So I had maybe a couple of different...
Now what you see is the advantage of this.
Exchange, really, exchange of ideas. Certainly growth for the students to be able to go live in another country for a few months.
Is the quality of work comparable?
Yes. It would be, because the person who became the director of this CNR, Mineral Research Institute in Rome, Anna Marabini, is really a leading person. Well, she's now retired, but a leading person in new reagents, in flotation reagents. In fact, she's a foreign member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, and so she had good ideas, but quite related to things that I had worked on. So it was, I would say, mutual, to mutual benefit of just getting different ideas and so on. And when she became director of that institute, the equipment and so on, she really, she moved it up a great notch in getting new equipment, better equipment, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. No, I looked at it as a good thing for, the two grad students who were there. I also participated in two such workshops in India, and one was 79, the very first one, and that I think was AID money also. And that had to do with resources that were an environment. It was more than minerals, but minerals was a part of it, I think food and energy and so on. And then we were in Bombay, and I remember Somasundaran was an American leader, and Professor Malikarjanan was Indian leader, and all our expenses were paid by AID money. And Soma had to go down, and we were in Bombay, at the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay. The meeting was first held in a nice hotel. Then we moved to the university for more discussion, but for 2 days there was sort of presentations there. And Soma had to go with a briefcase to a bank, and he came back with a briefcase or a suitcase, I think it was a briefcase, completely full of money.
Sounds like inflation.
And he said, he just was sitting in that taxi, just totally scared, riding out. I mean, only he knew that this was completely full of Indian money, and to pay all of our, to all the Americans, they were given the, whatever the, this would be for all the hotels and all your internal travel and that kind of thing, because there was one big wad of, of rupees. Poor soul was, he said he really was shaking almost on the taxi, uneventful of course, but, that proved to be quite, it was a complete variety of people. It was had to do with climate and agriculture. There was somebody I met named Scott from Caltech who he was a soil mechanics person. And if you remember about 1975, it showed pictures of Mars of a scoop on Mars shoveling the, he made the scoop and designed it all, and it was his project. I didn't even know him then, but he's a professor. I don't know if he's retired or not, Caltech, but that was a sort of, it wasn't just minerals. But then, a few years later, there was a workshop organized by NSF, India workshop by John Herbst and Jan Miller from University of Utah, and that was all related to minerals. And I had made the suggestion that we meet in Udaipur, and the Indians wanted to send all sorts of people, but it took them a lot of effort to say, hey, this is supposed to be an exchange workshop. If you have 100 of one and 20 about of the other, you can't have a... So we got it down to a reasonable number of Indians there. They wanted to meet in Delhi or something, but Udaipur is a beautiful city. And I had been there, so I suggested that. That's where we were. And that now was to work out exchange research projects in mineral processing, hydrometallurgy, pyrometallurgy, smelting. And that was a very good meeting where we met and planned different projects, and the U.S. part all got approved fairly early, and about 3 years later the Indian, whatever the Science Council was still thinking and waffling and couldn't come to decisions and so on, and on the short run that sort of thing died. Just never got going. But eventually there have been a number of U.S.-India exchanges. But you know what they all are Indian professors in the U.S. having an exchange with Indian professors in India, and they have a nice way to make a trip home. I mean, that's how I read it. Mm-hmm. In other words, my students saw.
Okay.
Well, I think having
the Indian students use this as a means.
That's how I read it. And I don't think it. Of course, we're now talking about good people, and professionally, but still, it's not.
A mutual.
It doesn't give quite the benefit you'd get in both directions if it were done on a broader scale. But of course, it's when an announcement comes for this sort of program, jump at it, or the Indians go to them because they know them, and so on. These exchanges exist between various countries. There used to be, I used to call it the Iron Curtain Exchange, because I had several people that came from Eastern Europe under this, that was IREX, I-R-E-X, I don't know what it stands for, but they would come and spend a few months here doing research, and I never had one that took me into Eastern Europe, but I know Soma Sundaran had one for quite a while with somebody in Bulgaria, and he would, Bulgarians would come there, and he'd go back there. So these exchange programs are useful. They had been, in the mineral area, too. Okay, I just want to briefly comment on some other types of international ones. I work in the field of surface chemistry, and I've always done a lot of very fundamental work, so I've been invited many times to straight surface chemical meetings by chemists, not minerals, and twice it was called Summer School for Surface Chemistry in Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. And this was, first one may have been 1970-ish, and maybe maybe 8 years ago or so, these are very, they might have been 2 weeks right on the Adriatic, and two of them that I went to were in Rovinia, which is just south of the border, a few miles, and beautiful coast where you had talks, and the talks would be lectures in the morning, and then afternoon free, and then and Yugoslavia did it right. They then met, evening session was like 5 to 7, so then you didn't eat till afterwards, because that made it nice. But we were there two different times, and so there might have been 2-3 Americans, but major European surface colloid chemists, and organized by the Yugoslav group, which was really very good in Zagreb, and so I had professional friends that resulted from that. And I remember one time, one afternoon, going to the city, maybe it's a half hour or less away by car, I forget how we got the name, Pula, I'll look it up, but a beautiful Roman Colosseum. There's a lot of Roman stuff there that's in good shape, that you can visit, in contrast to Italy, where a lot of it, got smashed and so on. But we, I told you I've been invited to the UPAC Congress in 79 and 69 in Australia. I've been to, invited two different times to what are called discussions of the Faraday Society in England, where these are, the two were involved with, one of them with oxide water surface chemistry, and another one in surfactant absorption. This is, you know, everybody there is really basically physical chemist other than myself, except that I was doing that sort of work. And then there's always the international surface science meeting, and one of the last ones was in Compiègne in France, 91, that, you know, that was a big international meeting. Again, mostly surface chemists. So
you do choose lovely places for these meetings.
Yeah, they're not bad. You're right. Compiègne is where the railroad car is, replica is there, where the World War I treaty was signed, and where Hitler made the French surrender to him, and then they took the car to Germany, and I guess they got destroyed, so what's there is now a reproduced car, but that's right there in the forest, right on the edge of Compiègne, and then, you know, another area that I've dealt a lot with is particle science and technology, and so I've been to many of the international particle meetings, mostly in Germany, Nuremberg, we've been several, and in Amsterdam. And so that's a different group of people, and that comes out of the research that, you know, we've done on pelletizing or on particle transport, mixing of solids, things like that. And this is not mineral processing people, but you know, so many things are handled in particulate form. I think somebody from DuPont said, and I had that in a talk, well, something like 85% of all of the materials they deal with in some stage they're dealing with particulates. So that's where, you know, the engineering of particles is so important. You know, it's pharmaceuticals, as we know, one of the place where they do, at least used to do a lot of work, is grinding a flour. You know how cake flour is. Mm-hmm. Well, cake flour has came about as a result of a lot of research in how do you grind in size and you know, and so on, so cement, of course, and so on. So when you look at it, how much of it that we deal with is particles. So there are these international meetings on, like I say, on particle science. Like, how do you measure the particles? How do you measure size, shape, size distribution? Of course, we do that in the mineral field, but a little bit on, more or less in the screen size. For some of these, you got to really do your particle size measurements in microns, and that gets very tough. But there, it's a whole field of that. So I've participated a lot in these meetings. And another one is Europeans have had European Comminution Symposium, and so I've had papers in, I think, every one of them, which starting with the second, which was 1966, and Professor Rumpf from Karlsruhe and Klaus Schirner were the two involved with that. And in September, I have I just got notice that accepting a paper for the 10th one, which will be held in Heidelberg in September this year. So,
oh, nice.
So I'm planning on doing that one.
Next year.
2002, right. And, yeah, the notification just came days ago. And so I've, you know quite well the people who've dealt with crushing and grinding, particularly in Europe, but that has also people come from other parts of the world, and so here at this stage in life, I still want to contribute a bit
huge
there.
Huge network, isn't it?
Yeah, and that makes, you know, so one, you know, has another array of people that I know, and I could make a long, long list of the world's best known people in all of these fields that I know personally, and that I think has been a
great
thing. Some of them are really as close friends, not just professional friends. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's.
Yeah, so you were speaking of the satisfactions of this worldwide network, and
yeah, I you know, have gone to enough of these meetings and of these different types, you know, outside of even the mineral meetings that I always take for granted as being part of, but take the surface chemical ones, I've really got to know the well and personally the still get Christmas cards from some of these people too, of what are really the world's giants in let's say in surface colloid chemistry. And by that I'll just like Overbeek, we've talked about before, but Otterwell is number the big man of England. Kitchener is another big man of England. Know very, very well, and in this country, and I'll fill a little in, but Matejevich, Zettelmeyer, Adamson, you know, the people who you think of, I know it. And in the world of particles, you know, Rumpf and Schirnert and Leshansky, and you know, one can go down the line. These people I know personally, let alone all the mineral people. Mm. But another thing is whenever we've had visitors, I often have, you know, invite them to our house for dinner. And when I retired, our kids, our children made some kind of poetic presentation, and one of the verses was what they learned, and what a part of their life was having these foreign visitors come to our house for dinner. And then I've heard each of them say, that meant to them, particularly our son, Steve, who is very good at talking with people, and I think he acquired this due to his interest when he was still living, you know, in high school, etc.
It broadened your family's horizons.
Oh, completely. So just another side aspect of it. And obviously it has meant a lot to our children, and they recognize that that's important. So that's just another plus of the kind of life that this is. But this has been.
Very broad.
And two different families are really close family friends, are the Healy's and Sherner's. And Elena died a year ago, but we've done so many things. In fact, with the Sherner's, we exchanged children in the summer. Ours went to Germany, and there's sons came here and stuff like that. Great. So it's been a good thing. So there's a.
Would you like to move on to the homestake board briefly?
Let's